How are you going to decide that? Well, we'll work that out. If we can ever get to the point over a table where we can discuss this, we'll work out how we decide how some people get this and some other people get that and some other people get the other thing. We'll learn to discuss and explore what's meant by need.
You're listening to a public course by economist, author, and activist Doug Dowd, which was given last week in San Francisco. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. We continue with Doug Dowd.
What does it mean, human needs? It's something that's never talked about in this country. Never. Never. You can't find any discussion except in the left side of the table, and nobody pays much attention to that.
How does Italy pay Social Security?
You would ask. Forget about it. The same thing with education, everything. I mean, it's the same. In Italy, in the first place, you get a sense of the difference. I live in Bologna. I don't know what it's like. I walk around Bologna all the time. I've been doing it for decades now. So I walk in streets and, you know, streets in various neighborhoods and so on. So I see things that I haven't seen in Rome, for example, or Milan, because I don't walk around them all the time. You walk around the streets of Bologna. In this neighborhood, or what they call a quartiere, a quarter, in this neighborhood, there's a little place, and there's a bunch of old people in their playing cards or whatever. They have places where old people can just come and talk to each other. And, you know, quite apart from the fact that they're taken care of, they have places for them, okay? They have places for them. And old people can talk to each other and so on. And, you know, the one place they always talk to each other, whether they can or not, every piazza you ever go to in Italy, it's always filled with old people sitting around bullshitting each other, you know, always. And it's, they do it because they know they can do it. Or if you're in the park, as I am, bicycling all the time, the old people are there with the grandchildren, you know. There's a sense of family there. This is really, I suppose, one of the things that's wrong in the United States. There's no sense of family here. I have no sense of family at all. None at all. You know, I know about it. I mean, I've had to, so to speak, learn how to think about other human beings. I didn't learn it at home because there wasn't any family, though. My father skipped out when I was six. My mother had to work all the time. She was never home. She's a very nice person, but she was working all the time. Okay? And there was no family at all. And when she got any money, she would go for a vacation someplace. She was a very nice person. I loved her dearly. But there was no family. Okay? There was just no family. Now, there are some families that get together in this country on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas and so on. Some of them even like each other. But the sense of family, I mean, for example, my aunt, my wife Anna, who's Italian, as almost all of you know, has six brothers and sisters. They really have severe things to say against each other, but they love each other. They can't go on without seeing each other. They want to see each other. You understand? I can't understand it. I do understand it, but I understand it as someone outside looking in, you understand? I mean, she has really ugly things to say about one of her brothers and one of her sisters, but she loves her. She loves him. But there's something about it that has the next step outside. It has those old people's places, and it has Social Security. I mean, you have Social Security there.
How do they pay for it?
Taxes. The way that Thomas Jefferson said when we started our fine country, ability to pay. It's a progressive tax system. They also have a big, what they call a value-added tax, which is a sales tax, which is regressive, but not as aggressive as it is, as it could be. So but you get, I mean, I'm going to talk, if I allow myself to get to it, I'm going to talk about housing here. The same thing is true for housing. There's a lot of subsidized, good public housing. I've been to many houses for dinner in those, and I say, it's a nice apartment. How do you go? Oh, it's public, you know. You pay some rent, but the rent is here, and the cost would be here if you were here, and so on. Education, I'm going to talk about that next this evening. It's not kindergarten through high school. It's prenatal. It begins with prenatal. It begins at birth. If you're a pregnant woman, you get 6 weeks off with pay before the child is born. And you get 6 months off with pay after the child is born. And the child has child care, which you don't pay for at all. And when he goes to school, they have a program, which let's say it's in grade school, where if the child wants to stay after school, there are teachers there who will talk to them, teach them after school. And the universities are free. I teach in two different universities in Italy. Both of them are free. Overcrowded, to be sure, but better overcrowded than undercrowded. And they're damn good students. The best students I've ever had in all my decades of teaching. Healthcare? I've told you all that. They're crazy people. But, you know, and you don't want to drive around there. You don't want to walk the streets and so on. And if you don't like cell phones, you don't ever want to go there because everybody's got a cell phone, two or three. But there's a sense of they know what need means and how to deal with it. Oh, I just want to say one more thing about the privatization, private pension. I think you all must have noticed in the papers recently about what's happening with companies like United Airlines and pensions and General Motors and pensions. They're really, United Airlines is, and the automobile companies are in a situation where it's make or break. They can't pay their pensions. If the unions won't go along with it, it's make or break, and so on. It's just obvious that it's going to be a disaster in terms of pensions. Now, these are private pensions. These are things that the workers earned through their unions, guaranteed pensions, okay, which they made contributions, the company made contributions. As the same thing is true for employee-financed health care. Both made contributions. But the companies run by the CEOs took those monies and didn't see it as a trust fund. They saw it as some way to use elsewhere. So the money that was supposed to go into their pension funds went into speculation instead. So that you have General Motors. General Motors owes billions of dollars to its trust fund. In any case, in the 70s, which was sort of a fadeaway for the 60s, the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation, government corporation, was established in order to guarantee these private pensions. Okay? Let me just read you something. The agency's executive director is a man named Belt, B-E-L-T. He has asked Congress to address the situation quickly. What situation? They've run out of money. The pension, the PBGC has run out of money. The agency's reserves are only $39 billion, but it owes $66 billion to people who are already not getting their pensions because their companies can't pay. And this was a year ago. The fire hadn't even gotten lit yet. And Congress, when he asked Congress to do this, they wouldn't do it. They would not increase the pension guarantee benefit fund. Okay? Even though this is the same Congress that says we ought to have private pensions, and when you have private pensions and they're guaranteed by the government and the private companies can't pay, you say, what did you say again? I didn't hear what you said again. What did you say? Go f*** yourself. I mean, anyone who would back private pensions, 401ks, all this stuff sounds like, you know, the ownership society. Hooray for me. I've got this little diddly I'm doing here and I'm going to get rich as hell and so on. But it's just absolutely, yes.
Well, before that, the people were on notice that organized crime had their hands in certain union pension funds. So Congress had no idea that if... That somebody else might later get their hands in it, like the CEOs? It's just they were blindsided?
No, I don't think blindness is the problem in Congress. I think it's wearing blinders is the problem. Like this, you know. I was conversing with somebody just the other day who had served in Congress. And He said, you have to understand that what's going on now is that everybody in the Congress has one primary concern, being reelected, and where am I going to get the money, and who's going to support me, and who's not going to support me. They're not talking about you and me. They're not talking about you and me giving them a couple of bucks, or you and me supporting them. What is owned now is Congress, and the state legislatures, and the city governments, to one degree or another, but to a very heavy degree in all cases. And they're all owned, and they don't have the time. They don't have the energy. They don't have the inclination anymore to do what people we like to think people in government do, which is make sensible decisions that are decent. You know, it's gone now. So the corruption is king, queen, and successor. You know, it's a hideous situation. Now, there's never been a moment in my life when there hasn't been corruption all over the place. But to say there's corruption all over the place is not to say that you're knee-deep in it. Now we're knee-deep in it. Or maybe we're up here, up to here in it. It's just awful. Let me turn to education now, just to start off with something about corruption.
One quick question before you leave that. Why don't they just seize these corporations' assets and pay for the pensions that way?
Lou, you've forgotten. We're in the United States.
No, I didn't forget that. I mean, but it seems like there's a public image that they have on the people's
own. Who does? Congress has a public image?
Well,
The congressional people are not going to vote for seizing any assets if they want to get reelected.
But they're stealing from their employees.
Oh, that's shocking. I didn't know that. I'm shocked by that. We should tell somebody about that. That would change everything. You know, Lou's a very sophisticated guy. He's kidding when he says this. Incidentally, when it comes to Social Security and everything else that we talk about in here, I always try to say that you should try to do some reading that's readable and useful. And this Dollars and Cents is a very good thing. They sell it here. Dollars and Cents, this particular issue was in 2004. But the most recent issue, every issue is very good, and they write for the general public, and lots of data and so on. This particular issue has two things at the top. Corporate tax giveaway, that's one article. The other one, what's Social Security crisis? And they just go on and on. And then, as some of you are familiar with Monthly Review, this Monthly Review was April of 2005, and it was all about, with a great emphasis on Social Security, and they probably still have it here in the shop. And the one in May of 2005 is very useful because it has a very, very good article, Lou, about what's going on with organized labor, a series of articles, very, very good. And there is something going on now in organized labor, okay? But it's a crisis kind of a thing, and it's more likely to weaken than to strengthen in the short run. Just as when the ILWU went on strike in 1934, it weakened them for a while, but not forever. But it's something that the general public should know about, that cares about these things, so that we can begin to sort of work with them, help them a bit. Let me turn to education, and we can try to find some time to discuss these things afterward. It's 8 o'clock already. This is something from a nice bimonthly, is now a bimonthly, called Multinational Monitor. And they have every issue. They just turned bimonthly instead of monthly. And every issue they have the Lawrence Summers Memorial Award for the person who's most absurd. The award is because in 1990, when Summers was working for the World Bank in 1991, in an internal memorandum where they were concerned with nuclear waste and so on, he said, And afterwards he said, I was just kidding. But they give an award now for people who are like this. He said, I'm quoting, just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the lesser developed countries? I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted. Their air quality is vastly inefficiently low compared to Los Angeles or Mexico City. Later, he said he was trying to be ironic. So this is the Lawrence Summers Memorial Award in this particular month, which was November 2004, was for the Philadelphia School District. I read. The Philadelphia School District has announced that it will sell naming rights to a new high school for $5 million. In other words, if I want to have that school called the Doug Dowd Philadelphia High School, and if I give them $5 million, and I've been thinking about that, and said, that would, I will get that high school to be named after me. I mean, I went to Galileo High, and I know goddamn well that Galileo paid to have his name put on that school. Meanwhile, we're closing schools. I start my education thing with school looks at its death sentence. And there was a headline in one of the newspapers last week or 2 weeks, four high schools in San Francisco, going to be grade schools are being closed at a time when they should be expanding so that the classes can be smaller. I'm talking about grammar schools now. My daughter's a grade school teacher, and I get all the bad news from her all the time. But that's not the worst of it. The worst of it is, ever since I can remember, what was going on in schools, my schools, grade school in San Francisco, high school in San Francisco, it had one quality to it that shouldn't be happening in schools. One quality, pervasive quality, coercion. Coercion. There should be no coercion in education at all. We think, well, we've got to have coercion, or else the kids won't do their homework. They won't do their homework because they don't see any reason. They don't want to do their homework. Why don't they want to do it? It's not interested in it. And yet, at the same time, we all know, or if we don't, we all should know, that children are the most inquisitive creatures on the face of the earth. They want to know about everything. They may not be able to concentrate very long, but that's part of it. Whether it's about animals or nature in general, why things are that way. When did that happen, Daddy? Why did that happen, Daddy? Or maybe it's music. Or maybe it's, we all know how they are about drawing and pictures. Or reading books when they get to the Bible. I mean, if they can read a book that they want to read, if it can be voluntary on their part, and why couldn't it be? Why couldn't it be? I remember very little about my own education up through high school. But I know it was a pain in the ass the whole way. A pain in the ass. Okay? I'm really very badly educated. I really don't know arithmetic. I don't know grammar. What I know about grammar, I learned from reading books I wanted to read. So I know how things sound, or how they're supposed to look. But I don't know the rules of grammar to this day. I do not know. So when I wanted to learn Italian, for example, and they said past participle, this, that, and the other thing, what the fuck are they talking about? Past participle, what's a present participle? What's a few? I literally do not know what a participle is, and I don't want to know. But I know what it's supposed to sound like, okay? But I never had this stuff. I only began to learn because I became political. I wanted to understand. And that was in the 30s. And when I went into the army, wouldn't you know it, I carried a trunk of books with me, like this, which is insane to do that, you know. And I went to flying school. I had a lot of marks, and I had a lot of this, that, and the other thing. But I also had a book that I really liked very much. It was written by E.B. White and James Thurber. It was called Is Sex Necessary? And it was an ironic take on all the sex talks that were going on in the 1930s. And in the flying school I went to, a military flying school, of course, they had the West Coast, the West Point system. They had a class system. Everybody was in that primary for 2 months, and they were in basic for 2 months, and they were in advanced for 2 months. And there were two classes. The first class was after their first month, they were the upper class, and somebody else is the lower class. And the upper class students always hazed, that is to say, tortured, that is to say, made life difficult for the lower class students. So there was some guy from L.A., and I was from San Francisco, and I think they stuck us together just because they knew there'd be a fight for that reason, because in those days there was a lot of hostility between L.A. and San Francisco. The other thing was that he was very short and I was very tall. So this short guy comes in and into my room where I was with a couple of the cadets, we were called, and he sees this trunk. He says, "What's in that trunk? Open it up." I open it up. And he didn't notice marks and angles and that sort of stuff. He saw "Is Sex Necessary?" He said, "Is that your book?" And I said, "Yeah, it's my book." "Why? You think I stole it?" "Say, sir, when you speak to me," he said, "kid." "Yeah, okay, that's my book, sir." He says, I said, "You want to borrow it?" He said, "Can I borrow it?" I said, "Sure." "Sex Necessary." So he comes back the next week, and he said, "I can't figure it out." He said, "I really don't understand. I still don't know. Is it necessary or not?" He probably went on to become a general. You know? The only good thing the Army did for me was it taught me to use the word "fuck" in every other sentence I speak. You know, of course, Norman Mailer's wonderful book, The Naked, The Dead, he never says "fuck," he always says "fug," because you couldn't print "fug" when he wrote that book. So it was fug 'em all. Can you imagine there was a day when you couldn't say "fuck"? Fuck 'em. You can't say it on the radio? And I won't go on the radio. So let's take up education. In the book in which this comes from, where I talk about education, the heading for that section is "The Deadly Sin," because it is really the most deadly sin. And I have a quote from, many of you know, the child psychologist, his name was Eric Erickson. And one day, I should say, he wrote this in a book of his. "Someday," he says, maybe there will exist a well-informed, well-considered, and yet fervent public conviction that the most deadly of all possible sins is the mutilation of a child's spirit. For such mutilation undercuts the life principle of trust, without which every human act, may it feel ever so good and seem ever so right, is prone to perversion by destructive forms of consciousness. I follow that with a nice quote from Vachel Lindsay, who was a poet in the 1920s. "Let not young souls be smothered out before they do quaint deeds and fully flaunt their pride. It is the world's one crime. Its babes grow dull. Its poor are ox-like, limp, and leaden-eyed." And then I follow that with a quote that I've given you before from Stephen Gould, the biologist who died last year. "I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent, have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops." That's what education should be all about, to see that that doesn't happen. I mean, I've said this before, I keep saying it all the time, because to me, I mean, after all, why would I be a teacher if I didn't think education was important? Education can't resolve all of our problems, because there's something about the larger society that poisons us to some degree or another anyway. But the larger society also, in our country, has poisoned education, I think, to the deadly point. I say this over and over again when I criticize the United States. It isn't as though there's paradise someplace else. Not in Italy, certainly. Certainly not in China. Certainly not in Afghanistan. Certainly not in Egypt. Certainly not in Nigeria. No place is there. There are certain awful things wrong everywhere in the world. Between the genders, between what are called the races, between the classes, everywhere. All kinds of horrible things. But in the United States, there is less excuse for this than in any other society in world's history. We have no excuse for this. We, quote, started afresh. We started with the richest resources in the whole world, all of them, for ours, to use as we chose, and we chose them to use them in ways that were self-destructive. It isn't that nothing good came out of it. We came out of it. But all of us, I speak for myself as well as you, are cripples. Emotional cripples, mental cripples, social cripples. We've all been taught not to think straight. We've all been taught not to feel straight. We've been taught not to trust our own feeling. We've been taught to join the herd, or else we've been taught to be conformists. I remind, as some of you know, that when de Tocqueville wrote that marvelous book about the United States and talked about the democracy of the United States was the greatest in the world, much better than his own France. This was, of course, after the French Revolution. He wrote this in the 1830s. But, he said, it is so conformist. It is the most conformist society. He wasn't including Asia and so on. He was the most conformist society. And he explained why it's conformist. And part of his explanation is part of what the explanation would have to be. This is before the media. He was talking about people who had come to a strange land as immigrants, who wanted to make out, he didn't use those words, who wanted to fit in. To fit in means conform. They wanted to become part of what came to be called a terrible word, but is looked upon admirably, with admiration, become part of the melting pot, to be melted away into something that had the character that we have, which is to say we don't have any character at all except we're, quote, Americans, unquote. Rich, if you don't like it, get the hell out of here. Oh, yeah. Uh-oh. I really can't see. Let me give you some data about kids. This is in an article in Mother Jones, another good, which is a local monthly or bi-monthly, December 2004. It's called Kids and Cash. Twice as much is now spent on marketing to kids than in 1992. That's just 12 years. It doubled. 30% of all children under the age of 3 have a TV in their bedroom. 30% in their bedroom. Until it went bankrupt, FAO Schwartz sold a functioning kids ATM for $20,000. Kids ATM. What? I didn't even know what that means. 2 in 3 parents think their kids define their self-worth by their possessions. You know that that's pretty close to the truth. 23 million children live in households suffering from hunger or food insecurity. To pay for a child's college education, parents will need to save $82,000 for in-state public colleges, $176,000 for private colleges. That was last year. Mm-hmm. The average public school teacher, like my daughter, Jenny, spends $521 of their own money to buy supplies for their students. My daughter gets a regular grade school teacher's salary, and she spends a lot of it for books and things for her kids, who are migratory workers' kids down in the valley. Bush's No Child Left Behind initiative has been authorized for $17 billion more than it has actually received. 3/4 of all public schools are in need of repairs, renovations, and modernization. Hillsborough, Florida public schools got $50 million for agreeing to sell only PepsiCo company products. 70% of public schools participate in a business relationship with corporations. 70%. 40% of the homeless are families with children. 89% of uninsured children are children of color. Teen and tween toys buy more than $2.1 billion in beauty products a year. Teen and tween boys, I should say. The U.S. has twice as many shopping malls as high schools. On average, states spend almost 3 times as much per prisoner as per public school pupil. The American dream unfolding. And now I turn to testing. I can't tell you how much I loathe the idea of testing, not just in order to get into the university, but testing in high schools, testing in grade schools. My daughter is teaching second and third grade school kids, second and third year kids, and she has to do testing. Now, if you have to do the testing, you have to teach for the testing because you, yourself, the teacher, get graded in terms of how your students do in the tests. And everybody knows it. And this is thought of by President Bush on up, or is it on down? By President Bush all the way, this is thought of, well, certainly, what else? That makes good sense. I mean, the teacher's kids are not doing well in the tests. There's something wrong with the teacher. Not that there's something wrong with the whole idea of testing. Because if there's anything coercive, it's having kids know that they're going to have to be taking tests and something, whether they care about it, know about it, heard about it, nothing. It's so deadly a sin to do that. It's just awful. And the schools get their funds under the Leave No Child Behind in terms of how they've done and so on. The whole thing is such a terrible degeneration to the whole idea of education, to the whole idea of trying to feed children's possibilities.
Yeah, well, could Bush pass the test?
Well, I couldn't. I said, I don't know. I couldn't have got into Berkeley, for example, if they had SATs. I just couldn't have done it. Couldn't do it today. I'm not a Dummkopf. I'm not Einstein or anything like that. But I'm a reasonably well-educated person. But I couldn't get by an SAT today. I don't know that kind of stuff. I couldn't ever get by the math test. I have trouble with arithmetic.
How'd you get a PhD?
I cheated. No, in fact, I'll tell you, when I became a graduate student at Berkeley then, in order to get a PhD, you had to do five fields, economic theory first and foremost, then economic history and history of thought, those two things. And then you could choose the other three fields. And economic theory was preeminent. And economic theory then was just beginning to become mathematized. This is 1948-49. And so they began to think and teach in this way. And I went to work. I had been a student, undergraduate student, for a guy named Joe Bain, who was sort of the number two guy in the country on monopoly and competition. He was not a left-winger, but he was an honest guy. And so I took his classes as an undergraduate. And while I was still an undergraduate, he asked me to be a reader in his classes, because this was not mathematics, this was monopoly competition. So I became his reader. And then he was the one who said, I ought to become a graduate student. And I was, as it happens, older than he was, because he hadn't been in the war or anything like that. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, my whole idea of going to school, becoming a PhD or anything like that, becoming a professor, was to overthrow capitalism. You understand? It was that simple. You can overthrow it if you don't know what it's about. So I went to learn about the whole system. And so when I became a graduate student, Joe said, you know, Doug, he said, you don't seem to do numbers very well. And I said, no, I don't. I said, I never studied. He said, well, I'm going to recommend a book to you. It's called Mathematics for Economists. And it's for people who don't understand mathematics at all, written by Joe Schumpeter, who was a friend of his, was a very good, very famous economist. Mathematics for Economists. So I took the book. I couldn't get beyond page 4 in the book. I couldn't figure out what the hell he was talking about. You know, there's all this sort of stuff. And so on. They have all these formulae and so on. So what I did was I translated mathematics into words for myself. You understand? So it was very difficult to do, you know, but I would take all these funny little things and it would be like I was reading music, so to speak, and hearing the tone out of it or something. And so I got through that. And Joe said, after I got up my PhD, and I wasn't examined on mathematics in it, I might say. He said, Doug, he said, you seem to do pretty well with Schumpeter. I said, Joe, I'll tell you the truth. I never got past page 4. He said, you're kidding. I said, no, I'm not kidding. I don't understand that kind of chicken shit, I said. Thorstein Veblen wrote a book in 1914 or 1912 about education. about the universities. It was called The Higher Learning, and its subtitle, original subtitle, was A Study in Total Depravity. And the publisher wouldn't accept it. Publisher wouldn't accept that. So he said, okay, and he changed the subtitle to On the Conduct of Universities by Businessmen, which meant the same thing as far as he was concerned. But the publisher, which was a business, they thought, what's wrong with that, you know? So it went through. And what Veblen was talking about in 1912, whenever it was the corruption of learning. The higher learning was ironic. Everything he wrote was ironic. And it's still valid, except what he was talking about was a rose garden compared to a garbage dump, which it is now. And now, of course, their final word is, in an increasing percentage of schools, they're not allowed to teach evolution anymore. Oy vey. What's next? So let me turn to housing.
Some of them are teaching intelligence design and evolution. Intelligence design and evolution.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't want to be a teacher in those poor schools. So let's turn now to housing and hunger. What I've been talking about in this whole human and social needs thing has as underneath it, as I think I said at the beginning, underneath it are two basic fundamental sets of ideas, which I think are well to keep in mind if you're going to be political about what's going on, if you're going to be engaged in any political discourse or dialogue with anybody. One is to understand that there is such a thing as basic needs. It's hard to argue against it. You can argue against fulfilling them. You can argue against the government having to be the party that does it, but you can't argue against them being basic needs. Okay, and that's what I've been talking about. Health, education, that's two of them. Nutrition is a third. Housing is a fourth. Excuse me. Opportunity is a fifth. And now, madly enough, water has become a sixth. It's really extraordinary. It's just extraordinary. It isn't just that we have to pay for water here. It's that the people in the poor countries have to pay for water. And it's really high cost water. As at the same time, what is causing them to have to pay for water is also destroying the lands on which they and their predecessors, their ancestors, lived. It's just horrifying, the whole thing. The other thing that underlies all of this is, as I think I talked about before, is that when we think about basic needs and say to ourselves, well, somehow or another that has to be supplied, guaranteed, assured, we also have to say something else. And everyone who works should receive for that work enough to live decently. It's what's called the living wage. I don't see how the Congress can't look itself in the face every morning with the minimum wage as it is. $5.15 an hour. Who's kidding whom? It's obscene. It's just obscene. In order for it to be a living wage, it would have to be almost three times that much. And they're not going to change it at all. If they do change it, what they're arguing about when they talk about it at all, and they get it off the floor all the time, it's the $5.85. It's just obscene. Okay. So when we talk about housing, again, we have to go back to a time when something constructive was done about housing in this country under a federal housing legislation. And when it first began in the late 1930s, which was when most of the new good deal stuff happened, 37, 38, 39, the idea was that there should be assistance for people whose incomes were not sufficient to give them decent housing, which meant that some people would get a subsidized rent, in effect. Part of their rent would be paid by the government. Some people would get a subsidized house that they could buy. Some people would get a free place to live. And you had federal housing projects and so on. And they were all over the country. And it seems to be forgotten that one of the consequences of the federal housing projects and one of the consequences of all the other New Deal projects was that they created good jobs and things that people needed. Whether it was dams, like TWA, or housing projects, or schools, or whether it was helping to subsidize the education of people who are going to college, like myself, for example, under NYA, National Youth Administration, in which while I was going to San Francisco Junior College, trying to make up my bad high school so that I could go to college at some point, I had to go to junior college 2.5 years in order to be able to get into the university. When I was going there, I was on NYA. First place, it only cost $1 a year to go to San Francisco JC. $1 a year. I went there in 36 to 38, and then again in 1940, 41, for 6 months. And there were a lot of people there because it was free. Free, I mean, $1 was free, in effect. And they couldn't get work, so they went to school. It was free. It was a wonderful thing to do. Cost $1. And also you could get work there in the school. So I was the assistant to a professor, and I was paid 40 cents an hour, which was the wage then, which is a lot more now. It would be a lot more now. And I helped her with her research until she got more interested in me than in her research. I was just trying to get an education, and I got an education. She was the one who gave me an education. Her name was Ruth. Ruthie. There's still federal housing going on, but the average person who gets it, I'll get to it right now, his income or their income is, her income is over $100,000 a year. That's where most of the federal housing assistance goes now. Why not? We have a very strong inclination here in this country, and I would say we're not alone in this, to think that if somebody's homeless or has poor housing, it's their own fault. We blame the victim. There's a very good book by that name. When the housing was going on, and when some of it was being used in the 60s and the 70s, for people who were mentally ill. In the 70s, a senator who's thought of as being a liberal senator, but was a piece of shit, Daniel Moynihan, introduced legislation to close up those houses where the mentally ill were living. I was teaching at San Jose at that time, San Jose State, and the houses that these people had been living in were in that area, in the area of the university. And what they did was every once in a while you'd see them walking around and they'd come and sit on the campus, which has some green sward and so on, and they'd be sitting there. Or some of you might even be reading a book or talking, chattering away, and there they were. And they were on some kind of medication, you know, sort of. And they were peaceful and so on and so on. And then they did away with those things. Now if you walk around the streets of San Jose, they're still there, but they're drunk, they're asking for money, they're homeless, they're miserable, they're even a threat in some cases. That's progress. My wife and I have a very nice house, and it has a garden that's much bigger. Have you been there? Much bigger than this room. And Anna tends the garden. There's a lot of work. So about 2 years ago, when I go on my bicycle, I go down to the marina, down to the bay, come back, and I come up Van Ness Avenue. And so there was this guy, and I would come up the street, and there was this guy always there with his hand out, in effect. And we began to talk. His name was Leonard. And after over a period of maybe 3, 4, 5 months, we talked about this, that, the other thing. Not a lot, but a little bit. He obviously wanted to talk. Because one of the things about homeless people is they're really lonely people, okay? Really lonely people, most of them. And so I asked him, what did you do before you were doing this, Leonard? He said, I used to be a tree trimmer, cut down big trees and trim them, and so on, and a gardener. Oh, I said, what happened? Well, he said, I did it for many, many years. He was from San Francisco. And then I married somebody, a Hawaiian person. And we went to Hawaii, and the thing didn't work, and the marriage busted up. When I came back, I couldn't get a job. I just can't get a job, and it's hard to get a job. So I said, I didn't say anything to him, but I said to Anna, who works her ass off in the garden, I said, look, there's this guy. Maybe he could help you in the garden. You know, we could pay him a good wage, and he could help me. And she was Italians are very nervous about their property, very nervous. They're very nervous about everything. So I said, you know, I didn't want to say anything to him before I spoke to her. She said, well, okay, but let's get some guns. You know, well, she didn't say that. So Leonard came up, and by God, he really knew what he was doing. And he did very good work. And when we go to Italy now, we pay him to come in once a week and so on and so on. But what's happened to Leonard? He doesn't sit on corners anymore. We spoke to a couple of people. We know a lot of Italians who have restaurants and things like that in San Francisco. We told him. So now he works for us. Now he works for this, that, the other. I was walking with the dog last week up a street, and there was Leonard washing the windows of some restaurant. I didn't even know he was working there. He's got these jobs all over the place now. You know? But that's not the important thing. The important thing now is he's a dignified person. And his morale is up here. Now, I can't believe that that's a unique thing, that there's something unique about him. Now he has a room. He used to sleep in the bush. He slept in a bush.
Yeah.
Martin?
Oh,
I say he's in his 50s, maybe 60. Just a strong guy, you know. So let me just read you some of the data about the homeless. The data say essentially that a third of these people, I think I've mentioned this before, are Vietnam vets. A third work, are family people who can't afford housing. And a third are people who are all screwed up from one way or another, but didn't decide to be that way. They live in a society that makes it easy for you to get all screwed up and difficult to stop being screwed up. In any case, if we were to have a program that had as its aim meeting the needs of homeless people, what would that program look like? Well, for one thing, it would have a lot of construction in it and jobs, not necessarily for the homeless people, but for people who need jobs doing construction work, which is usually well-paid work, well-paid job, okay? And so on. We would be doing something that would... It would be very good for industry because you don't do construction without using stuff and so on. We'd be doing all kinds of things that would be useful and which would cost very little compared with a Raptor bomber, for example. And would be used. We would be doing something, we'd be setting an example for our children and ourselves by doing something constructive, by building a project in terms of hope rather than disdain or hate or fear or whatever. Almost all the people I know, and almost all the people I know are good people, or I wouldn't want to know them, are afraid of homeless people. They're afraid of homeless people. They think they're going to rob them in the streets or something like that, which may in fact happen. But most homeless people are afraid of us. Much more, they're afraid of the cops. Leonard, incidentally, cannot... And they don't allow, they arrest you now if you try to get money in the streets in San Francisco. That doesn't mean they arrest everyone. It means that that's the law. You can't do it. You can't do that anymore. So what are you supposed to do? And so on and so on. Anyway, it's an absolute disgrace that there are so many homeless people in the United States, and it's estimated there's something like 7 million of them. One thing that really gripes me, as I bicycle through the Presidio every day. It's all those empty buildings. They are being filled up gradually, but they're being filled up as high-cost real estate or as high-cost businesses. Whereas the original idea of the Presidio, as you may have read in the Chronicle, was in the Chronicle yesterday or today, was to have the place be a place where projects could work out for social needs and so on. And there's a bit of that. There's a bit of that. But every day I bike by what used to be Letterman Hospital. You know what's there now? Lucas. It's the biggest goddamn thing in the whole world, I think. You can't see it all from the grounds because it's the only good thing they did was they didn't allow it to become a skyscraper. It's all two-story, three-story buildings. And they made them paint them the same color as all the buildings. But Letterman Hospital was a useful hospital. And the one that was torn down was a relatively new hospital. And there's a shortage of hospitals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What the hell are we doing? And the main square with the parade ground. The top building, you know what it can be used for now? Disney. It's going to be a memorial for Disney. It's going to be a museum for Disney. It's an insult. Disney was a fascist, for Christ's sake. He was a fascist. This is a disgrace. This is what's happening to this country. The last thing is hunger, okay? When you're talking about hunger, the first thing we should be talking about is not hunger in the United States, although there's plenty of that. It should be hunger in the world. And the second thing you should be saying is that how can there possibly be hunger in the world? Unless it's an obscene world. The people who are most desperate in the world, whether you talk about Africa or Latin America or good parts of Asia, including China, the people who are most desperate are people who once worked on the land growing food, who've been pushed off the land, including China, in the hundreds of millions, in order to put factories there. In Mexico, it's a globalization of agriculture, but also somewhat manufacturing, but mostly of maquiladoras and so on. But most of it was the globalization of agriculture, agribusiness and so on. The poor people all over the world, I can give you some data on this. It's just hideous. Even in the United States, the Department of Agriculture in the United States estimates in 1999 about 36 million people in the United States are without adequate access to food, and about 20% of all children between the ages of 15 and 18 live in what the Department of Agriculture calls hungry homes. That's their words. In the United States, with our restricted production, with our subsidies to the rich, which makes it impossible for the poor to compete, all this kind of really insane economics. But it isn't just insane. It's wicked. It's rotten to the core. And it gets more and more and more and more all the time. At the same time that all this has been going on, the farm population in the United States, in whose name all of this was done, from the 30s on, from the 20s on, the farm population has gone from being over half of the population of the United States of America to being less than 2% now. And where a few big companies get most of the income that is presumed to be the subsidy to keep the family farm going. The family farm is ADM, which is a criminal organization. Quite literally, it had to pay $100 million fine. How the hell that got done, I don't know.
But they didn't do anything wrong.
All they did was fix some prices. That's all they did, with the help of the Japanese, incidentally. And whether it's hunger or housing or education or healthcare, there is simply no acceptable reason for anything that's going on, especially in the United States. The richest, proudest, quote, most democratic, unquote, country in all of history. The most powerful country in all of history. If they've got power, you've got responsibility, kids. We've got the power, and we don't take the responsibility. We could change all of that, not by ourselves, but just by doing it. Then everybody else would do better than they're doing now. They'd be able to, they'd be pushed to, they'd be happy to. The Europeans would love to have to become better because the United States is becoming so much better. Instead, what they're doing is becoming worse day by day by day by day with respect to everything because they have been pursuing U.S. policies. Who has? Those who have power in their societies have. And the people have let them get away with it. Italy, I know very well. Italy's a disgrace. The Italian left is a disgrace. They've just been sitting back. They are Kerry speaking Italian. Over half of U.S. adults are overweight, as it happens, and a third are obese. Worldwide, 1 billion people are overweight. And at the same time of that, at least 2 billion are malnourished. And at least 12 million kids die from malnutrition every year. How do we do it? How can we do it? How can we put up with it? We put up with it. People in this room, we're putting up with it. Too much. We may be against it, we may fight against it, but we're not, none of us, myself included, is doing enough. We just... At least 80%, to pursue the note I said a minute ago, at least 80% of the world's chronically hungry live in the countryside, and more than half of them are subsistence or were subsistence farmers. Their inability to feed themselves has been attributed in part to pressure from the world's wealthiest farmers, heavily subsidized. That's from the Food and Agricultural Organization. I close this chapter by quoting Carl Sandburg. Some of you know who he was. He was a great Illinois poet of the 1930s and earlier and subsequently. He wrote a poem which ended this way. Who can make a poem of the depths of weariness bringing meaning to those never in the depths? Those who order what they please when they choose to have it, can they understand the many down under who come home to their wives and children at night and night after night as yet too brave and unbroken to say, I ache all over? How can a poem deal with production costs and leave out definite misery, paying a permanent price in shattered health and early old age? When will the efficiency engineers and the poets get together on a program? Will that be a cold day? Will that be a special hour? Will somebody be cuckoo then? And if so, who?
You've been listening to economist Doug Dowd's public class series on the USA, where we are, and where we're headed. For more info on Professor Dowd and his work, visit www.dougdowd.org, DOUGDOWD.org. Thanks to Michael Slaughter for his heroic efforts in getting this audio to us so quickly. You can contact this program on Welcome Guests or download archived MP3s of this show at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.